And now to another book that comes with some political baggage. The story begins in 2005 when a Danish newspaper published cartoons depicting the prophet Muhammad. The cartoons led to riots around the world. Some 200 people were killed. Yale University Press has just published a book about the controversy called The Cartoons That Shook the World. And as Diane Orson of member station WNPR reports, that book has sparked a controversy of its own.
No place for hate!
About a dozen Yale University students are protesting a visit by Danish cartoonist Kurt Westergaard, who drew the now iconic image of the Prophet Muhammad wearing a lit bomb in his turban with the Creed of Islam written in Arabic on the wrappings.
For some people, I am a kind of provocation. I go for the dialogue, but it is not very easy. I have tried to speak with many Muslims, and often the conversation has ended up in a curse, you know, go to hell and burn up. And I have asked, perhaps we could talk in hell.
There were many different reasons why Muslims were upset.
Jutta Clausen is a politics professor at Brandeis University. She was in the Middle East at the time of the cartoon controversy, interviewing Muslim leaders for another project. She signed a deal with Yale University Press to write an academic book unraveling the events that led to the violence. In doing her research, Clausen found out that imams and activists in Denmark exploited the cartoons to incite Muslims around the world. She also learned that the demonstrations which followed were sponsored in part by radical Islamists and in part by governments.
The Egyptian government and the Turkish government were extremely instrumental in pushing forward the conflict. They primarily wanted to put on record with the United Nations that Europeans and Westerners discriminate against Muslims and are Islamophobic.
Clausen, who's Danish, spent 3 years researching the book. The manuscript went through the usual academic peer review process. Then, just a few weeks before publication, Yale University, which owns the Yale Press, mounted a second review. The university asked some 20 scholars, counterterrorism officials, and national security experts to assess the risk of more violence if copies of the cartoons were included in the book.
And it was fairly overwhelming.
Yale Press Director John Donatich.
The people who knew the most about this kind of situation said, don't do it, that this is likely to provoke violence.
One of the experts was former Director of National Intelligence John Negroponte.
I felt that there was a considerable risk that more violence, possibly even resulting in serious injury or death, could occur as a result of the publication of these images.
The university told the press to eliminate the cartoons from the book, along with all other images of the Prophet Muhammad. Clausen was told she'd have to sign a non-disclosure agreement if she wanted to read the experts' comments. She declined to do so. But she says she was even more dismayed to learn that the panel had not read her book.
Well, my first reaction was that it was stunningly similar to what happened during the conflict itself. And I disagreed with the experts' advice. I felt had the experts read my book, they would not have given the advice they produced.
Still, Clausen decided to publish with Yale Press. Tariq Masood of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government says both sides were grappling with sensitivity to Muslims and Islamic culture. On one hand, Yale didn't want to offend Muslims by reprinting the images.
But I would also argue that Professor Clausen is coming from a similar place as well, that you can publish the cartoons without inciting violence, that Muslims are not really these excitable people who are irrationally given over to violence and anger.
Back on campus, Yale student Fatima Ghani says she's glad the press took the cartoons out of the book. She says they're not an expression of free speech, but hate speech.
People don't see this the same way they would see a swastika or they would see the N-word. They see bigotry against Muslims in a separate category as they see bigotry against other races or religions.
But critics, from the American Association of University Professors to the Penn American Center, have opposed Yale's decision to publish a scholarly book without including the images of the very subject the book covers. Some people charge that the university is concerned with its image in the Middle East. Clausen says Yale overreacted.
I cannot recall any similar instance where anticipatory fear of adverse consequences to Yale University private interest or perhaps more general public interest have ever influenced how a book is presented and how a scholarly debate can proceed.
Clausen says she hopes that a later edition of the book may include the cartoons. In the meantime, she's begun thinking about another project, a look at the impact of national security on the world of academic publishing. For NPR News, I'm Diane Orson in New Haven.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
In Pakistan, as we said earlier, targets for suicide attacks have been wide-ranging, from an aeronautical manufacturing complex to an all-girls school. We wanted to know how people are reacting to all this, how it's affecting their lives. So we called a number of people who live in Lahore. That's the second largest city in Pakistan after Karachi. It's often called the cultural heart of Pakistan. We called a number of students and professionals and others for their perspective on how these attacks are affecting them. We found the phone lines of wildly varying quality, and we finally reached Mina Hussein. She's a school teacher for an all-girls school who's currently on leave, taking care of a newborn baby girl. We spoke to her by phone. Thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on the new baby.
Thank you.
So tell me, how have you heard about these attacks? Have they been widely publicized? Are they very much in the news?
Oh, absolutely. We have a lot of news channels going on now. So there's a little wide range to choose from. Because Islamabad is very close to Lahore, for example, and you know, you have family, friends, loved ones. So even if you're not near, tell you, someone will text or call and see if you're okay.
As I mentioned, you were teaching at a girls' school until the
yes.
baby came, and your baby is a little girl. Did you feel any special, what's the word I'm looking for, any kind of special anxiety when you realized that a girls' school had been one of the targets?
It's not about whether it was a girls' school or a boys' school. The thing is that it was a school, and there's students there. For me personally, as a teacher and a writer and a literature person, I feel that a school or a university campus is some place where that's the only place you can be really, truly free in your mind or to speak out and to have opinions. And I think it's a symbolism of putting a bomb in a school is what bothers me the most. This is an everyday freedom. It's not somebody up north in Waziristan being bombed or shooting people or blowing things up. It's right here in your backyard. It's in, you know, the city that's a four-hour drive away.
How do you think this is affecting your neighbors, your friends? And you know, obviously, this is very frightening because it seems so. On the one hand, you're saying, on the one hand, yes, when they're attacking military installations, you can say, okay, these are combatants. But now this is you know, this is civilians. It's children, it's teachers. How do you think it's affecting your friends and your neighbors? And just to the degree that you can give us a sense of what are people saying?
It's sort of a mixed bag. We come with some Islamic baggage in the sense that we believe, as most people do, that you die when you're supposed to, when you're destined to. So that's a sense that, you know, if we're going to die when we have to, it doesn't matter whether you stay at home or you go to this, or you go out shopping or you go to school. You know, your time will come when it does.
Mm.
I think that now people are getting angry because there was still some sympathy for the Taliban. And, you know, the fact that, you know, maybe not all of them are so bad or that, you know, the government should take care of this problem themselves and not necessarily seek help from an outside party. But now everyone is angrier. If the Masoods are behind it, then they've really lost, I think, whatever sympathy they had. Any scrap or smidgen of sympathy they had is gone now.
Hmm. Well, Mina Hussein, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Not at all. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations again on the new baby.
Thank you very much.
Mina Hussein is a school teacher, and she's currently on maternity leave taking care of her new daughter. She joined us by phone from Lahore. Part of what is fueling the conflict in Pakistan is, of course, competing visions of what the world should be, visions rooted in conflicting interpretations of what Islam demands. But Pakistan is certainly not the only part of the world where the casualties of religiously inspired conflicts are mounting. That leads some to ask, is it time to try to get God out of our lives, at least our political lives? Karen Armstrong takes on this extremely sensitive question in a recent issue of Foreign Policy magazine. She's a best-selling author of many books about matters of religion and spirituality, including her latest, The Case for God, and she joined us now from London. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
In your piece, you say the question isn't whether God is alive or dead in political thinking, but is God a force for good in the world? How do you answer that question?
Well, religion is difficult to do well. If the political environment in which a religious movement is flourishing is unhealthy in any way, is fraught with conflict or tension, then it's likely that God will not be a force for good in the world. But whether we like it or not, whatever the pundits or the intellectuals or the politicians say, there is a religious revival going on in nearly every part of the world at the moment, except in Western Europe, which is beginning to look remarkably, even endearingly, old-fashioned in its secularism. So the idea is really, I mean, God is here, whether we like it or not. The aim should be to make sure that God religions flourish in healthy, peaceful, just conditions.
You seem to be saying, forgive me for being, not to be trivializing, but you can't beat it, then at least understand it.
Yes, I think very often I find that foreign policy people tend to sort of look down their noses at religion. I remember after the Iranian Revolution, for example, it said that a member of the State Department in the US said in exasperation, "Who ever cared about religion?" But if they had taken a little time to study the history of Shiism and its recent manifestations in Iran, they would have avoided some unnecessary mistakes. So religion is one of the factors on the ground that needs to be taken into account in a scholarly, balanced way, just like the physical environment, like the economy, like social conditions.
Is that really possible? Aren't you inevitably going to bring your own faith commitment or lack thereof to an analysis of the situation? Because by definition, to many people, faith is a mystery. It cannot be explained to those who don't adhere to it or don't wish to for whatever reason.
There are things you can find out about a religious tradition, and there's plenty of helpful books around that will enable you to do that without compromising your own beliefs in any way. I mean, you have to set your beliefs aside if you're planning a foreign or economic policy in many, many other fields. And it should be possible to look in an appraising, intelligent and educated way at religion. The more we learn about other people's religion, the less frightening it seems, and the more we start to understand what's going on in people's minds and hearts. That's just as important as knowing what's going on in the economy.
To whom is this article directed? I was curious about that from the beginning, because as you mentioned, there is a religious revival around the world, with the exception of Western Europe. I mean, the leaders of the United States government in this administration, the previous, the one before that, have always been religiously committed men in one form or
yes.
another. So why do you feel a need to make the case for God, as it were?
Well, I was in Washington a couple of weeks ago having dinner with a whole bunch of people, some from the White House, some from the Defense Department, some from the political media programs. And they were all sort of saying, well, we don't really need to know about religion. So it really, to them, I think, saying, look, things are not black and white. They're not as they seem. You know, I mean, you mentioned in your startup that Pakistan conflict there seems fueled by religious hatred. In fact, Pakistan is quite a secular country in many ways. It actually reminds me of 1950s Britain in several important respects, the Britain that I grew up in. And it's by no means as rabid as it seems. What happens is that when conflict becomes rooted in a region, religion tends to get sucked in and becomes part of the problem. So I think I was just sort of untangling a few of the shibboleths that people often in media, in political life, adhere to, like God and politics don't mix, for example. And that's sometimes true, and sometimes it's not.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we are going to continue our conversation about God and politics with writer Karen Armstrong. And if you want to hear more of our conversations about the role of faith in public life here and abroad, please go to our website. That's the Tell Me More page of the new NPR.org. Please stay with us. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, not every young, educated, and politically active college graduate is headed to work in a law firm or the government. Some are headed to the farm. We'll tell you why. We found out in our weekly peek into the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's coming up. But first, we continue our conversation with Karen Armstrong. She's the author of many books about religion and spirituality and the history of religion. At a time when many observers are blaming religious fundamentalism and in some cases religion itself for a host of international conflicts, she has written an article for Foreign Policy magazine taking on what she sees as dangerous myths about the role of God in global relations. Karen, you say in your piece that unfortunately it is not a myth. It is true that God is bad for women. You say that even when a tradition begins positively for women, as with Christianity and Islam, within a few generations, men, as you put it, drag it back to the old patriarchy. So what is to be done?
That's one of the real flaws of all the what we call the major faith traditions. Even the Buddha had a major wobble when it came to admitting women into the Buddhist monastic order. Even in Christianity and Islam, which started out with a positive message to women, within a few generations, as you say, the old patriarchy is reasserted. But now, you know, in all the major traditions, women are making a comeback. Buddhist nuns are demanding that their orders are taken as seriously and given the same status as those of the male monks. And we've got women fighting for ordination in some of the Christian denominations and to the rabbinate in Judaism. And, you know, there are a surprisingly articulate and forceful number of Muslim feminists who are forcing their menfolk to look at the Quran, at the hadith of the prophet, at the prophet's practice, and demanding that their menfolk respect what seemed to have been the prophet's wishes regarding the equality of women. So this is a flaw that has to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And of course, unfortunately, in the fundamentalist movements, which are in every single faith rebelling against secular modernity, there is a retrograde movement tending to overstate the traditional subservient role of women, because one of the hallmarks of modernity, of modern society, has been women's emancipation. And so as they create their countercultural protest against modernity, fundamentalists, be they Jewish, Christian or Muslim, tend, as I say, to overemphasize the traditional roles.
Well, that's kind of bad news for half the population.
It is indeed. But on the other hand, help is at hand. Women are making a substantial contribution. I hope they'll make a good one. I hope that when women do come to power in religion and in politics, they bring something fresh to the table and don't just slide into the old patriarchal male roles. You know, Mrs. Thatcher was a bit of a disappointment in that respect, for example.
Well, another conversation for another day. But and finally, just to conclude, your piece is clearly a, I don't know what you want to call it, a shot across the bow, at least a direct sort of answer to many of the arguments by secularists about why religion should not have a place in our public life. You address such questions as God is the enemy of science. You say he doesn't have to be, that no. God is incompatible with democracy. You say clearly not. So you wish for secularists to rethink their attitude toward religion. Is there any way in which you would want the religiously committed to think about, to rethink their attitude about God?
Absolutely, yes. I think that we have a choice right now in both our religious and our secular traditions. We can either emphasize those that speak of exclusion, of disdain, of hatred, and these are in all traditions, be they religious or secular, or we can emphasize those that speak of compassion, of respect for other people, of a quest for justice. And the religious people need to make that message come forth loud and clear.
Karen Armstrong has spent much of the past 25 years writing about the centrality of religion to the human experience. Her most recent book is The Case for God. It's available now. She recently published an opinion piece in Foreign Policy magazine about God in social and political life. If you want to read the piece in its entirety, we'll have a link on our website. Just go to npr.org. Karen Armstrong, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
A bold new Jewish lobbying group called J Street held its debut conference in Washington this past week, and it's raising hackles in the American Jewish establishment. J Street plays on K Street, the sometimes infamous street where many Washington lobbying firms are located. J Street was founded to, among other things, secure peace for Israel, but also provide a counterweight to the more dominant American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, known as AIPAC. AIPAC has long had a huge role in determining America's relationship with Israel. By many accounts, it sees J Street as its new rival. Jeremy Ben-Ami is the founder and executive director of J Street. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, by the way, Washington does not actually have a J Street.
That's exactly right. And we are filling a gap in the political map of Washington.
Well, let me ask what's going on. You've been called a fifth column, Stalinist, the surrender lobby, terrorist sympathizers, and I could actually go on. You had 1,500 people at this conference. Where is the criticism coming from?
Well, I think that the voice of moderate, mainstream Jewish Americans who recognize that peace in the Middle East is essential to Israel's survival has been missing for a very long time. A small minority has controlled the debate and spoken for the entirety of the community. And now that a new voice is coming forward, there's a sense of fear and threat, and they're pulling out all the stops to try to delegitimize and silence our voices, and it's not going to work.
But these appellations, why do you think people are so freaked out?
I think that the predominant emotion in the American Jewish community when it comes to considering conflicts with one's enemies is fear. And I think that's a pretty reasonable and understandable emotion for a lot of this to be based in. And so I think we're talking about some very, very profound and serious issues that tap into a collective consciousness and soul over centuries in which a people has been persecuted and killed in mass numbers. And I think folks don't want to be involved in something that might be counter to the community's interests. So it's this is a difficult conversation, but I think it's a really important one to have, and I think we've got to help people get beyond the fear. And, you know, I do believe that a organization and a movement based on hope is going to trump a movement and organizations that base themselves on fear.
What is your own connection to Israel? Your family is from there.
Right. I have a very deep personal connection. My great-grandparents actually were part of what's called the first Aliyah. They moved from what's today Belarus to Israel in 1882 and established one of the very, very first towns, first Jewish new settlements, when settlement was a good word. That was 127 years ago. And my father was in the Irgun, the right-wing terrorist movement that helped fight for independence for Israel. So I'm deeply personally connected to Israel and to the issue.
So, Jeremy Ben-Ami, do you really think you can deliver? AIPAC has tens of millions of dollars and is very influential with a lot of Congress people, several of whom backed out of their invitations after saying they were going to come to your conference. You have just several million. Do you think you can deliver?
Well, I don't put us, you know, in any way in opposition to any other organization. I do think that we have done incredibly well for 18 months. We started out in my basement with no budget and no staff and 400 people on my personal email list. And here we are 18 months later. Next year we'll have a $4 million budget. We have nearly 30 staff. We have 115,000 people on our email list. So I think that there is an appetite in the community and an appetite in Washington for this new voice.
Jeremy Ben-Ami is the founder and executive director of the new pro-Israel lobby, J Street. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to NPR News. Halloween may be over, but there's still more celebrating to be done. November 2nd is El Día de los Muertos, or the Day of the Dead. Reporter Sky Road sent us this audio postcard about a gathering in Hollywood, California, in observance of the Mexican tradition.
What hits you first when you walk through the iron gates of Hollywood Forever Cemetery is the sense of joy. It's in the bright colors, the flowers, the music. And in a place full of dead people, celebrating a holiday that's all about dead people, joy is a welcome companion. Día de los Muertos grew out of ancient Aztec and Maya traditions. Mix them with Spanish invaders, Catholicism, and close-knit families, and you have the one day of the year when they say souls can return to Earth to visit their loved ones.
And all those little details that we enjoy when we've been alive. Por eso es que traemos todos estos altares.
Many of the altars set up for these souls spread out the same way Los Angeles does, more wide than tall. They hold photos and precious possessions, banners of colorful tissue paper cut into patterns, smiling skulls. And everywhere you look, there are marigolds, strung together in garlands, tucked behind ears, blanketing the altars.
The scent is supposed to attract their spirit to come back and visit us that day. Skulls, which represent death. The candles, which is the light, that they're going to follow the light to come in and visit us tonight. The food, you see the chilies and the bread, and it's just for them to come and feast today.
Marisa Mendoza made masks and picture frames for her dead relatives.
My grandfather loved the Dodgers, so I made him a blue one with the Dodgers on it. And my grandmas were really fancy ladies, so I made them a fancy calavera mask. My grandfather up there, the green one, he loved his gold tooth, so I put a gold tooth with a little fancy mustache.
Families pour through the cemetery gate as the sun sets. Many head straight to the face painting tent for a makeover. All white, dark circles around the eyes, skeletal grimace drawn on. Then they wander past the candlelit altars. The sense of community is a given here. Everyone has loved and lost. The goal is to remember and celebrate. The visitors crowd toward the stage as Mexican singer Lila Downs starts performing. But many of the family members stay close to their altars. It's peaceful at this crossroads of the living and the dead. Alimento para el alma, one altar maker calls it. Food for the soul. For NPR News, I'm Sky Road.
This is NPR News.